Matthew 24. Jesus went out of the... He departed from the temple. His disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "See you not all these things? Verily, I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age?" Now, of course, they in their mind thought, well, for this temple to be destroyed, it must indicate his coming in power and the end of the age. That was synonymous in their thinking. Two-part question. Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places, and all of these are but the beginning of sorrow." So, Jesus Christ now finishes his rebuke of the religious leaders in the temple, 23:37, as he said, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets and killest those that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee under my wings as a hen gathers her chickens, and ye would not. Behold, now your house is left unto you desolate, and henceforth you shall see me no more till you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And of course, the guys are shocked to hear this. He just said to them, well, your house is left desolate. And they related desolation with Nebuchadnezzar, with the Assyrians. Desolation to them was something different than it is to us. And they thought, your house is left desolate. It says then they took Jesus and began to say, well, look at the temple. Look at these stones. It had been 47, 48 years in building by this time. Maybe longer than that, just one of the wonders of the Roman world. The Romans were the ones who were building it. There were stones in the foundation of the temple itself that weighed hundreds of tons. There's one there today still at the base of the wall, 47 foot long, 12 foot wide, and over 8 foot thick, and it's cut to lay on bedrock, so the top is level, 600 tons. 750 tons, one stone. Jesus is saying there's not going to be one stone left upon another. It's not thrown down. They're thinking, how can you even flip one of these? What are you talking about? What's going to go on? Look at these stones. Look at this construction. This is an icon of national and religious Israel's security. You know, it would be like if Jesus Christ said to us today, "See the Washington Monument, see the White House, see the Capitol building. In a few short years, it's all going to be gone." You know, it's one thing for us to read it in the tabloids, but when Jesus Christ says it to you, you think, what in the world is going to happen? It kind of leaves you in a quandary. So where am I going to be if all that's going to be gone? What's going to go on here? So they're calling his attention to the building, the magnificence of the building. Rome's building it. Who's going to overcome Rome? If Rome's building it, who's going to tear it down? And Jesus says to them, then, do you see all these things? As he questions them. Do you really see them? You see, because Jesus Christ was the one who saw them. It says he wept over Jerusalem because they didn't know the time of their own visitation. When Jesus Christ looked at that temple, he saw the stones that would be thrown down. He saw Titus Vespasian surrounding Jerusalem in 70 AD. He saw the history of the Jewish people laid out in advance. He saw us here in the mall 2,000 years later. They'd have never believed that if he'd have told them. He saw all the way to the second coming and the end of the age. So Jesus saying, do you see it? And he knew they didn't. He knew they saw a beautiful building. They saw massive stones. Jesus Christ is the one who really sees Congress. They better worry about that. Really sees the White House, really sees the Supreme Court, really sees the military state of the world. He's the one who really sees it. We only see what we get to lay eyes on. And he questioned them. Do you really see it? Do you really know what's going on? Not one stone's going to be left upon another. And of course, Vespasian, when he came, had given orders that the temple would not be destroyed. It was one of the wonders of that world. And one of the soldiers mistakenly set that temple on fire. $2.5 billion worth of gold melted down between the stones. And as they knew the temple had lost its value anyway, they pried those stones apart with pry bars to scrape the gold out from between the stones, and there was not one stone left upon another. And as you go to Jerusalem today, you can see them down in the street that they've excavated, thrown down, crashed on top of houses, a mute testimony to the fact that Jesus Christ knows exactly what he's talking about. And if he knew what was going to happen 40 years in the future and called it shot by shot, he knew what was going to happen in our day also. And it's important then for us to know what he says. Now, the problem with prophecy is that it's suffered from neglect and it's suffered from overemphasis. On one side of the coin, Jesus said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They say to you, red sky in morning, sailor take warning, red sky at night, sailors tonight. They can predict the weather by looking at the sky, but they can't predict anything because they don't see the signs of the times. And Jesus said, one of the rebukes to religious people is that they are unable to put together a scenario of where the Bible says we are. And all through the scripture, we're told to watch, and the idea has the idea behind it of look at the conditions of the world, look at biblically where it says we are, and you should be able, as Bible-believing Christians, to put together somewhat of a scenario that tells you where you are in relationship to time and eternity. And certainly there are enough signs around us today. The other side of the coin, you've got, of course, the Ripley's believe it or not side of Christianity that comes up with every hokey and phony and nutty thing and says, oh, this is a sign. Oh, the guy hitchhiking, you pick him up, he gets in your back car, tells you Jesus is coming, he disappears, you know. Or the drill bit that fell down into hell and they listened down the hall and everybody was screaming down there in Siberia. Or, you know, the things in the tabloids that we hear about. I remember years ago when we first started the study in 1981, there was a track out, and it talked about the birds of prey, the eagles and vultures in the Middle East, and how instead of laying one egg, they were laying five eggs. You know, the mother eagle would go, ah, you know, and surprised that normally she would lay one egg, but she was laying five eggs, and how the birds of prey were multiplying, and it was a phenomenon, and to be a phony thing. The guy who made the first batch sold so many tracks, he didn't care what was true. He mass-produced them. They were good sellers, and we bought it. So on one side, there's been neglect. On the other side, there's been the nuts. And, of course, your grandmother's going to say to you, well, they said that when I was a kid. The guy had the sandwich board. The end is coming. Repent. They've always said that. Now, let me tell you something. There's one difference in our generation that there has not been in any generation of the church since Jesus Christ predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. And we saw that in 70 AD. The difference is, all prophecy presupposes the reestablishment of the nation of Israel. Jesus said, you're not going to see me henceforth until you say, speaking to the Jews, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. He said it to Jerusalem, to the temple. He presupposes it will be reestablished. All prophecy presupposes the reestablishment of the people and the nation of Israel. And that sets us aside from any generation that's ever lived. Now, Christ may not come for 100 years. I believe he's coming soon. But whenever he comes, we're closer to it than any generation of the church has ever lived. And just the fact that a miracle has taken place, you don't know any Babylonians. The Seneca Indians have not come back to Manhattan 300 years later and said, here's your beads, we changed our minds, we want Manhattan back. And besides that, we want to join the UN. That would be ludicrous. The Jews have come back after 2,000 years and taken over their land and give you tours of Roman ruins. That's pretty remarkable stuff. And that makes it different for us than any generation that's ever lived. Now, Jesus said that these things that would take place would be the beginning of sorrows or birth pangs, birth pains. And that also is an important phrase because if we say today, well, wars, there's so many wars, that means the Lord's coming. No, there's always been wars. Last 300 years of history in Europe, there's been 300 wars. One scholar studied the history of man said for every 1 year of peace, there's been 13 years of war. So war is not a sign. Famines are not a sign. There's always been famines. Earthquakes, not a sign. Pestilence, which, by the way, means deadly infectious disease, not a sign. But what he says is they're the beginning of sorrows, the beginning of labor pains. I've been through this labor thing four times now. My wife has been through this labor thing four times. I've observed this labor thing four times, and I know my way around it. Now I know what's going to happen. I know when to say breathe, and she says, you breathe, you know. You know, I know what's going to happen with it. It isn't like she gets in the ninth month and she's all swollen up and I say, oh, you kidder. It was just a psychological pregnancy. It's not really going to happen. I see the signs. It becomes evident. I know what's happening. And it's the same thing. Earth is in transition. We're headed into heavy labor. The point is, when all of these things are present at one time and Israel is back in the land and they're increasing in their frequency and in their intensity, like when your wife's on that fetal monitor and things go, and she's going, ah, and then it comes back down again, and then, ah, and then they get closer together and it's time for you to leave. You see, that's the point. Just like labor, I mean, early on you get a Braxton Hicks contraction. It's, oh, you know, it goes, hits your kidney or does whatever it does. But then once you get there and water breaks, you know, the world seems like it's about to break water when I look at it. You know, your wife is in her third trimester because she's hot and sweaty and miserable. And, you know, I look at the world. It's hot, it's sweaty, it's miserable. It's in a third trimester. It's mean and sweaty, and look at it out there. Look at the news. And the point is, it's no longer the nut with the sandwich board that is being the prophet of our age, but it's some very well-established people that are telling us these things. Dr. George Wald, Harvard scientist, Nobel Prize winner, says this: I think human life is being threatened as never before in the history of the planet, not just by what one peril at a time, but by many perils coming to a head at the same time. And that time lies somewhere close to the year 2000. Notice that point, important time. I am one of those scientists who find it hard to see how the human race will make it past the year 2000. Dr. Norman Myers, environmental consultant for the World Watch Institute, says this: no generation in the past has ever faced the prospect of mass extinction in its own lifetime. Now, that's coming on many fronts. Ecologically, it's coming in the medical realm. It's coming because there's 29,000 nuclear weapons finding their way onto the black market. It's coming in many different faces. No generation ever faced the prospect of mass extinction in its own lifetime. No generation in the future will face a similar challenge, because if we get by it now, that'll be the crux of it. The problem has never existed before. If this present generation, listen carefully to this, if this present generation fails to get a grip on the task, the damage will have been done and there will be no second chance. And certainly, I don't expect this generation to get a hold on the task. I was riding with my dad yesterday in the car. We were talking about world conditions, and he happened to say, look, you know, it's almost like it's so intertwined, there's no way out. It's all wound up in a ball. I said, that's right, no way out. That's Luke 21, perplexity of nations, Greek, no way out. You're right, that's where we are, no way out, there's no way out. It's up this way, there's one way out. That's what we're waiting for. The book of Revelation tells in the first chapter that Jesus Christ sent to show his servants things which must shortly come to pass, entaxia in the Greek, and people have made fun of the book of Revelation for 2,000 years saying, well, nothing shortly came to pass. What do you mean, things which must shortly come to pass? That was written 2,000 years ago. Well, the phrase indicates that once those things begin, they'll come to a rapid conclusion. That's the idea. They will snowball once they start. And we are seeing, obviously, the beginning of those things taking place in our own lifetime. I look at this bombing of the World Trade Tower in New York, and it reminds me that there's now been a psychological barrier that's been broken, that the Muslim world, the Arab world, the terrorists hadn't stepped through before, and now all of a sudden that's taken place, and they're wondering, if they can do it again. Before there was terrorism, it wasn't on American soil. Now there's been terrorism here right in our home, and I think it's broken down a barrier, and we're going to see more and more of it. The FBI is going to have to work harder and harder to keep it from happening again. Again, during the Persian Gulf crisis, and I had the paperwork here. Oh, there it is. During the Persian Gulf crisis, there was a ship that left Iraq. We didn't find out till it was on its way. It had six Scud missiles, came up into the North Atlantic, and was going to lob them into New York City. Biological heads, 600 miles off the coast. I mentioned it Wednesday night, and one of the pilots from Willow Grove came up to me and said, I flew missions on that. I didn't know anybody knew about it. What are you doing talking about that in church? And I said, well, I don't know if I'm supposed to know about it. If I disappear, I wasn't supposed to talk about it. But got up into the North Atlantic. He flew missions over it. He said, we had orders to sink it if it got within so many miles of the coast. He said, I never heard the end of the story. He said, what did happen to that? I said, as far as I know, another agency took it down. We still don't know if it was Mossad, M16, the Russians who took it out. Somebody sunk it. We were sitting here watching CNN, watching Baghdad and what was going on over there. That meanwhile, they were hoping to get a shot at us right here off our coast. How long will it be before a nuclear device gets into a van instead of plastic explosives? Very easily. And I think, as Don McClure said, God owes it to the rest of the world to let them see that democracy doesn't work either. Russia has collapsed. The rest of the world can't put their hope in democracy because we have destroyed it in several hundred years. Have a report here. It's called From the Sea, the Role of the United States Navy in the 21st Century, completed September 92, signed by Sean O'Keefe, Secretary of the Navy, Frank Kelso, Admiral U.S. Navy, Chief Naval Operations, C. Mundy, General U.S. Marine Corps, basically says the United States Navy will become the police force of the world. You see it as you watch the TV now. I don't know if you realize it or not. You see American troops in Yugoslavia with UN berets on, blue UN berets. Who decided, when did you decide and vote for your army to be used somewhere else? When did you decide that our national security is owned and run by the UN? When did you make that decision? Because you pay their salaries, you pay their taxes. The idea is it's been taken out of our hands. And don't get me wrong, I think that we need to pray for the president because I would not want his job. I think as the leader of the free world, it behooves him to try to work for a world order. The only thing, as a Christian, we know that that's going to end up in tyranny when there finally is a world order and somebody running roughshod over the whole thing, that it's going to end up in the worst tyranny the world's ever seen. But on the other hand, I think his position as a responsible human being, even as a Christian man, if he happens to get into that position, if a Christian man gets in there, it's his responsibility to work towards world order. Tough position to be in. I'd just rather stay home and watch somebody else do it. I wouldn't want to do it. I have another report here. You come up and look at these afterwards if you want. Please don't borrow them. I need them for another service. This is called The Immediate Solution to the United States Problem of Impending Economic Collapse. Completed November 92. I also have the thank you letters that have come from Congress and Senate in a file just from this spring as they work through it. Done by H. Lindsay Arizin III, Senior Financial Administrator for the Department of the Air Force. And he basically goes over oil consumption, oil production, the top 40 banks in the world, the top 500 banks in the world, fossil fuel, hydropower, countries sorted out by nuclear dependence, gold reserves, central banks and governments, U.S. money in circulation per capita, U.S. bank failures, 1960 to 1990. Interesting piece of paper, interesting brochure. I will read some highlights because I believe this affects your life. As Christians, we have believed all along that the final theater of world confrontation will be the Middle East. Certainly our security people are watching North Korea now because last year they were the world's leading exporter of arms and a trouble spot. But the stage always shifts back to the Middle East. This report says the top seven banks in the world are Japanese. Japan has 19 banks out of the world's top 40 largest banks. The largest U.S. commercial bank is Citibank. It ranks 29th. We have one bank left amongst the world's top 40 banks. Despite the fact that the Japanese have a great deal of currency and have increased their gold reserves by 15%, over 3 million fine troy ounces since 72, this is the key, they don't have any real control over the substance that makes their industrial complex run, O-I-L, capital letters, oil, the center of banking, the center of civilization, the center of what's taking place now. This is the discriminator. By acknowledging their oil problem early on and planning wisely for the future, Japan has ensured it will have the money to keep the elixir of industrialization flowing. The United States, on the other hand, is rapidly running out of oil. We neither have the money to buy it when the well runs dry, nor an operative plan in the interim. Now, that was this guy's job, to come up with an operative plan facing what we're facing and then try to get that into the brains of political people. We have no plan to reduce our vulnerability unless we take steps immediately to develop alternative energy sources and find ways to use oil more efficiently. The United States economy faces potential collapse before 2001, in the next 8 years, is his forecast. In what areas are we most vulnerable? Based on 89 data, automobiles and light trucks alone account for 40% of U.S. oil consumption. Transportation sector of the United States economy is considered in toto. It consumes 63% of our total supply of domestic and imported oil. Problem number one in relation to that, we are running out of oil. The United States produces 7.3 million barrels per day. It consumes 16.6 million barrels a day, over twice what we produce, we consume on a daily basis. That, with the present reserve, gives us 9.75 years before we run out of oil. Critical fact, based on our 1991 crude oil production rate of 7.3 million barrels per day, and assuming we are able to import enough crude oil and refine products to meet our needs, our reserve will last till September 2001. Now, why they don't think it'll last till August or October, I don't know. They've got it down to September 2001. All European Economic Community oil will be depleted by September 1999. All CIS, which is the former USSR oil, will be depleted by February 2007. All non-OPEC oil worldwide will be depleted by December 2008. Japan already consuming 353 times as much as it produces. Israel consuming 558 times as much as it produces. The OPEC Arab-producing oil nations control 77% of the world's oil. The Middle East contains 68.5%. Saudi Arabia alone accounts for 26.2% of the world's oil. Now you know why we were so gracious in defending Kuwait. Now you know why we're so humanitarian being in Somalia. It's because the Sudan lays right to the north of it, and it's the world's leading terrorist training country right now. Now you know what's going to happen politically, as nations are either going to turn their back on Israel to have political favor with the Arab nations and oil, or nations are going to place their might there militarily so they have access when they need it. If we defend Saudi Arabia, we still have at least a line on some oil. Very important. In addition to the grave fact that all non-OPEC oil worldwide will be depleted by December 2008, it is revelatory that after thousands of years of economic evolution, the European community, the United States, the former USSR, Japan, and Israel will all run out of oil within 9 years of each other, from 1999 to 2008. Critical fact in regards to running out of oil: approximately 70.3% of the world's population, 3,781,903,000 people, are over 70% dependent on fossil fuel for electricity. What that says is over half the world's population needs oil to run the generators to make these lights go on. When the oil starts to dwindle, The gas price is going to go up at the pump. The oil price is going to go up at the market. Electricity is going to go up through the ceiling. In the next 4, 5, 6 years, we're going to see incredible things happen that affect us. And as American Christians, we have studied prophecy for years. It's always been interesting, but it hasn't really put a finger on us yet. As terrorism now is spreading to our soil, as this situation with banking and the oil and world gold reserve and so forth, it's all coming home to us now to roost. And we're going to see it. It's going to have an effect on our lives. Out of the top 500 largest banks in the world, the United States has 99. In those 99 banks, our total assets are $1,800,000,000. Japan, on the other hand, has 106 of the top 500 banks with $7.5 trillion. Almost seven times our reserves, our capital. East Germany has, even Germany only has 40 banks in the top 500, $2.1 trillion, almost twice, going on twice what we have in assets. Listen to his, how he sums this up. This is his conclusion. Again, you can look through this, and he repeats what he said before, and I guess you have to do that to make your point in Washington. Because of its rapidly decreasing oil reserve, the United States is facing an unprecedented crisis before the turn of the century. We are running out of oil. We don't have the money to buy what we'll need when the well runs dry, and we don't have any operative plan in the interim to reduce our vulnerability. We need commitment now to the transition to a post-fossil fuel age, as well as an era of advancing energy efficiency. It will take several decades from whenever we start to wean ourselves from imported oil. Our long-term economic, environmental, and national security future hangs on this transition. Here's his conclusion. I like this. Ancient Chinese proverb worth repeating here as he ends. This is it. If we do not change our direction, we are very likely to end up where we are heading. That's scary. I see the humor in that, but that's scary when I think of Washington changing direction. At present, this is where we are headed, towards years of global tensions and conflict, notice, over increasingly costly Middle East petroleum if we continue to procrastinate. What it tells us is the rest of the world is running out of oil and the Middle East is not. And it will become the pressure cooker of the world. And the Bible has told us that all along. It's been plain to us. Now it is reaching down to touch you and I. They talk about it in Washington. They don't talk about it to us. And I believe that there's no problem reading this right now. Also, the other thing I wanted to touch on is the area of pestilence. And again, it really gripes me when I see what's taking place and I think how little we are told. If you would like to educate yourself, you can read Lorraine Day, her book, AIDS, What the Government Isn't Telling You. It will help you get your head out of the proverbial sand, because a lot of Christians that are well-wishers and desire to be compassionate have got their head filled with political nonsense and don't have an idea of what's really taking place in our nation or in the world in regards to this disease. In 1981 and 82, they told us that it was only 1 out of 1,000,000 chance that you would get a bag of blood if you needed a transfusion that was poisoned or that was contaminated. By the beginning of 1985, they admitted then 1 out of every 100,000 to 250,000. Before the spring of 85 was over, they said, okay, it's 1 out of every 50,000. And in 1987, they came back and admitted, the government, that all the way back in 1982, they knew it was 1 out of every 100 blood donors that was giving contaminated blood, and that if you needed 2 or 3 bags on the table in surgery, your chances were not very good of coming out clean. And it's because it's become a political issue instead of a medical issue where it belongs. And I think too much of the time we've bought into it. Now, again, they say that the homosexual community New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, 70% of male homosexuals are HIV positive. But they're telling us, but that's slowing down. It is. There's only 30% left. It has to. That's what they don't tell you. They make it sound like this educational victory that's taken place. Yeah, the rate of increase is decreasing because there's only 30% of the people, original people left to get infected. It has to. It has to. It's very plain. Also, I'm going to just hit some highlights of this for your benefit. In 1981, it was believed that AIDS did not transmit through blood transfusions. It took 14,000 to 16,000 victims with HIV from transfusion to get our authorities to admit that death was being kept in the refrigeration and frozen blood bank inventories. In 1983, it was believed that AIDS did not transmit heterosexually, at least not in America. In Africa, maybe, surely not here. Now, obviously, that's all changed. 1987, it was believed that to be stuck with a needle was harmless. Obviously, that information has all changed. We now believe in 1991, as if this was wisdom that has come down on stone from Mount Sinai, that HIV does not transmit to children living in a household where there is HIV. It says, we have learned to our dismay that it's in the blood banks. We have learned to our dismay that it's transmitted heterosexual. We've learned to our dismay you can get it from needle stick. We've learned to our dismay the way it spreads. Now she says there is no evidence from experimentation for us even to say that it can spread that way. And the problem, she says, in Zaire, Africa today, 1 in 3 people are HIV positive. Out of those 1 in 3 people in Zaire, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of those are children. Those children are not homosexual. They are not intravenous drug users. They are not getting transfusions. They are not swapping body fluids. And somehow they got the disease. That's the point. And we have our head in the sand back here for lots of political reasons. That's what she's trying to communicate in the book. She says one of the catch words that you're going to hear now, and she says, we have all heard heartwarming stories of kind-hearted people who have taken castaway AIDS babies into their homes, and as Christians, maybe that's the only place these babies will get love. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying know what's happening. They've hugged them and kissed them and burped them and changed their diapers with no problems. Will this be true 10 years from now? The buzzword now is no identifiable risk factor. When you hear no identifiable risk factor or NERF, it's a buzzword that means I got AIDS and I have no idea how I got it. I'm not an intravenous drug user. I'm not a male homosexual. I am not promiscuous. I don't get transfusions and I have AIDS. Says this, 3 to 5% of all AIDS cases reported in America, including children, have no identifiable risk factor. In 1989, diagnosed AIDS cases increased by 14% compared with 1988. Of the total number of AIDS cases, 5.2% had no identifiable risk factor. That 5.2% represents 1,848 cases in America of people who have no idea how they got it. In 1989, that is an increase over 1988 from 1,012. That is a 55% increase in 1 year. And the stats are not in for the last couple of years. 55% increase in 1 year of people getting AIDS and having no idea how they got it. And the results are in here. You can read it for yourself. Pasteur Institute says that the virus stays alive in dried blood or dried semen or dried saliva 7 days outside the body. and is still contagious. One of the major problems, and the cat is out of the proverbial bag, and nobody wants to talk about it, and they don't want you to know about it, is with the new antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis that's spreading in our nation. 70% of the people that have the antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis are HIV positive. Being HIV positive or having AIDS, and the Center for Disease Control estimates 1 million in America, 20 million worldwide, and in some areas in America, 100 times the reported cases. By the turn of the century, 65 million people with AIDS, that's a seedbed for diseases that we've considered eradicated for years. It's not just people with AIDS, it's people without immune systems. The problem in the prison system today is this. We're having men turn up with antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis. As they test the prison system to see who has TB, the men with AIDS don't get a reaction to the test because they have no antibodies, because they have no immune system. They end up to be the carriers, but turn up negative to the test. So now the prison system is thinking about mandatory testing for AIDS. DNA testing, so they can stop the spread of antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis. And when you think in Philadelphia, in some of our hospitals downtown, 20% of all the beds are AIDS, and 20% of all outpatient care in Center City, Philadelphia is AIDS, and 70% of the people with antibiotic-resistant TB have AIDS, you get an idea of what we're beginning to look at. And the question is this. AIDS is primarily spread, so far that's a propaganda, voluntarily. The question, of course, now is, can you get it in different ways? TB is spread involuntarily. It can be spread in conversation. It can be spread by sneezing. They found the AIDS virus inside of the tuberculosis bacteria. Their question is, if you get the antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis from someone that's HIV positive, have you also contracted AIDS? They don't want to talk about it. Those of you in the medical community know they're talking about it at Temple. They're talking about it at University of Pennsylvania. They're talking about it at the Center for Disease Control. And everybody else has got their head in the sand. She writes an interesting little clip on Philadelphia in here. Philadelphia, despite voluminous educational programs, and I've seen one of those voluminous educational programs, South Philly High, and publicity about AIDS, nearly one-fourth of the 1,329 people surveyed in Philadelphia are still engaging in high-risk behavior. The large numbers of people have misconceptions about the way the disease is spread, a city official reported. While the extent of knowledge about AIDS, listen to this, among Philadelphians generally equals or exceeds that of the rest of the country, many Philadelphians have yet to change their behavior as a result of AIDS. That's Philadelphia. It's happening everywhere. Blue Cross sent out a memorandum to us here at church because that's the plan we have. A year and a half ago, estimated 40,000 people in the workforce in Philadelphia that are HIV positive. We have people that told us when the blood mobile came to one of the high schools in the area, 20 kids gave, have to be over 17, have to be over 110 pounds. Those kids that gave, five of them were HIV positive. Out of 20, had no idea. They said the football players, the jocks that are in the locker room sharing a needle, shooting steroids or spreading AIDS around, don't even know it. They said the kids that are piercing their ears, they said make sure if you go somewhere have your kid's ear pierced, that they use a different pierce for each kid or sterilize properly. They said the problem in high schools now, kids are piercing their ears, passing around a needle, and they're passing around the virus. There's an order out to ophthalmologists now when they try on contact lenses, for you to get contact lenses, to throw each pair away, not to put the same pair back in the next person, because it can spread the disease. And the biggest lie of all, this voluminous educational program, they're telling our kids in public schools that if you can't abstain, you should practice safe sex. What they don't tell them is that the virus is 10 times smaller than the porous hole in a latex condom, and there's no such thing as safe sex. Wilder Smith, when he was here, said 6 years ago in Switzerland had the lowest amount of AIDS per capita. Through their researchers, they decided to press a safe sex program on the whole nation to keep it that way. They put up billboards of Heidi with a condom on her thumb. They pray all over the country. Now, Switzerland is the highest per capita in all of Europe, AIDS, because the condom is so porous, you might as well not even have it on. People are such up in arms, they're refusing to pay taxes to the government in Switzerland. And they tell your kid in a high school, practice safe sex if you can't abstain. And let me tell you something else. Everybody's going to stand before Christ in judgment. There's no such thing as safe sex unless you're married. AIDS may not get you, he will. We'll all be accountable for our behavior. Here's how ridiculous it is. This is a monthly magazine that comes out on environmental issues. And this is an article written to people who work in water treatment plants. It says, recent scientific study by Leonard Kazan, University of Pittsburgh, focused on the survivability and infectivity of HIV in sewage wastewater, as well as wastewater that is undergone normal wastewater treatment methods. In his study, wastewater, this is at the treatment plants, because you see the hospitals, everything flushes everything down, it ends up in the sewage system. In this study, wastewater samples were taken from a treatment plant, primary treatment effluent and non-chlorinated secondary treatment effluent. Samples were inoculated with HIV, prepared and tested in blood lymphocyte cultures. The results, it tells that AIDS, the HIV virus, has survivability in wastewater up to 12 hours. At 48 hours, there was a 2 to 3 log function decrease. It was still alive and infective after 48 hours in a water treatment plant. Taking on HIV transmission, as dangerous as it is, impervious to clothing, gloves, boots, it should be worn by any worker with possible exposure to raw or non-chlorinated wastewater. Gloves with minimum porosity should be used. The size of the HIV virus is much smaller than the pore size of the standard medical latex glove. Multiple gloving is recommended. It's an article written to our wastewater treatment plant workers that if they want to be safe, they have to put on more than one layer of latex glove. And we're telling our kids in high school, one condom is going to protect you, and we're slaughtering a generation. I believe the two areas, you know, as we look at this here, and in the evening we'll have more time to spend with some of the different things that are going on, but two things that are really going to impact your life and my life is, one, this medical problem that faces our nation because it's handled in such a sloppy political fashion, and it's become a political disease. Secondly, the other thing that's going to have a tremendous effect on us is this oil situation and everybody's attention right now behind the scenes focused on the Middle East, wondering how they're going to maneuver and get themselves into position so they don't run out. Well, what it is God turned off the tap everywhere else and left it on there because he wanted all nations to come that way, as he said they would. And God's word is being fulfilled. It's going to affect our lives now. It's going to touch us. It's going to come across our path. I think if the Lord tarries any length of time, we're going to appreciate the body of Christ more than we ever have. Find a home fellowship you can walk to. And look, this stuff, we read through this stuff, it sounds kind of depressing. But it isn't, because it means Jesus Christ is coming back. He said that's why he bothered to tell us you're going to see all these things, because if he didn't tell us and we saw all these things, imagine being an American citizen or somebody who's informed in our military or somebody who knows what's going on who doesn't know Christ. What are they doing? Building houses in the mountains, storing up arms, storing food, storing gasoline? I mean, what would you do? I mean, it becomes very obvious to me things are snowballing. They're happening more quickly. It's the return of Christ is imminent. The return of Christ is at hand. Whether you're a post-tribulationist or a mid-tribulationist or right, it's at hand. The coming of Christ is at hand. That's not bad news. You know, it makes me have hope as I look at my children. It makes me have hope as I look at the world around us. I realize this is happening so quickly that at any moment we could be called out of here. That's not bad news. That's good news. If you don't know Jesus Christ this morning, you're looking at bad news. It's in the paper. It's all around you. And what you don't know, you don't want to know. And if you don't know Jesus Christ this morning, you need to make up your mind. We have hope. We believe he's coming. We believe he said every one of these things would happen just the way they're happening and told us when you see them happening, get ready, I'm almost there.